Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Cool Kwanzaa, Happy New Year, and definitely do Diwali, which, quote, signifies the victory of light over darkness, knowledge over ignorance, goodness over evil, and hope over despair. And if that doesn't cover your traditions, happy holidays, Buon Capodanno, Feliz Navidad, Xin Nian Kuai Le. Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 83 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or join the discussion there. Follow us on Twitter at Infectious Myth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs. And I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I'll send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want the show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you're gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. This is the last show of 2015. Thanks for listening this year and also in 2014 when the show started. I look forward to things getting bigger and better in 2016. Although it was difficult to get guests around the Christmas season, things are shaping up nicely for early next year. I hope to start by addressing the issues of Native people for the first time and return to the subjects of vaccines and shaken baby syndrome. If you have ideas, please send them to me. And if you disagree with my position, the best way to get back at me is to suggest a credible guest to make your argument. I don't need somebody who's going to yell at me when I disagree with them, but I certainly would like to have a respectful discussion with people who do disagree with me on some of the important issues that I've covered. Today I'm on by myself, so let's start talking about heroism and kindness. According to the Associated Press in a 22nd of December report, a bus in Kenya was stopped by jihadi terrorists, and some of the Muslim passengers on board gave non-Muslims headscarves to try to conceal their identities as Christians when the bus stopped. And in so doing, they saved several people who are not Muslims from being killed. I think these people represent the bulk of any religion. Most Muslims, most Christians, most Buddhists, most atheists are kind people who would never kill anybody else. And a small number of violent terrorists don't represent any community. I also should point out that if the Muslims who gave headscarves to Christians had been discovered, they probably would have been killed as well. So it was a truly heroic gesture. Slate on December 18th reported on a high school football player from Knoxville, Tennessee, who was killed shielding three girls from gunfire during a random shooting spree. One of the girls said, "If it wasn't for Xavion, the football player, if he had just run off the porch, we would probably have been shot." Dobson's brother went to try and help the football player, but quickly realized it was too late. "I found him on the porch and I picked him up, and he was lying in my hands dead." I should point out that Xavion was a black young man, and many people who have a problem with the black community point to the high level of violence among blacks, the high level of gun violence. But again, that only represents a small portion of the black community, and people tend to ignore the many people who are nonviolent, or in this case, outstandingly heroic, even at the expense of their own life. Kindness is probably more important than heroism because kindness is something that we can all do every day, whereas opportunities for heroism don't come along all that often. A Muslim family was dining in Augusta, Georgia, and when they went to pay the bill, the check was brought to them, and they were told it was already paid, and written on the check was, "Paid, Merry Christmas, beautiful family." On the other hand, in Virginia, students were assigned an Arabic phrase to try to copy to get an understanding of Arabic calligraphy. The phrase in Arabic said, "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah," which presumably no students who didn't understand Arabic could have possibly read. And it would seem strange that a student would suddenly convert from Christianity to Arabic by being shown one sample of Arabic Islamic calligraphy. But due to threats to the school district had to be closed for some time due to the fear that this engendered. A Fox station in North Carolina reported 13 cases of pertussis, also known as whooping cough. What they said was, "The spread of whooping cough is most easily prevented by receiving the DTaP shot. However, and this is particularly troubling, all 13 of the people confirmed to have pertussis have gotten the vaccine." Speaking of vaccines, the flu vaccine is steadily becoming a joke, and people are realizing this. It's largely ineffective. Even institutions like the Cochrane Institute have had noticed this. It usually contains mercury, and many people have had negative experiences with it, not necessarily terribly negative, but they may have taken it and got the flu or felt bad afterwards. This has resulted in Italy in an article in La Repubblica, a major Italian newspaper, that the vaccine coverage of the general population has dropped from about 18% to 19% between 2005 and 2010, down to 13.6% in the 2014-2015 season. And amongst the elderly, where they're being heavily pressed to get the vaccine, it has dropped from over 68% in the 2005-06 season, down to just under 50% in the 2014-2015 season. What's also interesting is that the number of cases of the flu have generally been in decline, from almost 800,000 in the 2009-10 season to a low of 400,000 in the 2013-2014 season, an increase to over 600,000 in 2014-15, but it's hard to see an exact trend. But apart from the most recent year, it was basically down every year despite the reduction in vaccination. Another important vaccine is hepatitis B. An article in the journal Immunology Research from late 2014 by Dominique Le Huizec, and I've probably butchered his French name, states, "In 1994, the French health authorities launched a national vaccination campaign of all pupils in the first year of secondary school. The following year, hepatitis B vaccine was added to the national immunization program for all young babies and teenagers. This immunization campaign quickly exceeded its expected targets by also encouraging the adult population to be mass vaccinated, whereas the vaccination of the infants remained less significant. This resulted in an unprecedented wave of immunization in adults, with 20 million French individuals vaccinated against hepatitis B, concentrated in 4 years from 1994 to 1997. Multiple sclerosis cases in some vaccinated adults were rapidly notified to the French National Pharmacovigilance System, triggering an investigation by the agency. This inquiry, started in 1994, was therefore already underway when French media revealed possible occurrence of post-immunization multiple sclerosis in 1998. That year, French health authorities abruptly terminated routine school-based vaccination of preteens, and adult hepatitis B vaccination began to be less widespread. And in this article, there is a very compelling graph that shows how the sales of hepatitis B and the reports of post-vaccine multiple sclerosis, the initiation of multiple sclerosis shortly after hepatitis B vaccine, are very closely correlated. And when the vaccination program stopped in 1998 and the amount of vaccination in the general population dropped, so did the number of post-vaccination multiple sclerosis cases. It's somewhat difficult to tell without some careful research, because there are also many other causes for multiple sclerosis. We've talked on this program about aspartame, for example. But In many cases, it was noticed that this occurred just after vaccination, and that's what caused the French government to act. It also means that if people are not allowed to criticize vaccines, then these kinds of waves of increases in acute and chronic diseases will not be notified, will not be published by the mainstream media, and many people will be injured unnecessarily. Canada, which actually is relatively lax on vaccines compared to the United States, is participating as enthusiastically as the United States in attempts to coerce parents to get their children fully vaccinated. Canada's capital city, Ottawa, is the latest community reports health impact news, putting the screws to parents and their children over vaccine compliance. Ottawa is enforcing Ontario's Immunization of School Pupils Act, which requires students to show proof of vaccination against tetanus, diphtheria, polio, mumps, measles, rubella, meningococcal disease, pertussis, whooping cough, and varicella. 900 Catholic school students have already been suspended over the lack of immunization records. Ironically, parents have a pretty easy way to opt out. All they have to do, according to the law, is to file a statement of conscience or religious belief with the proper medical officer of health. So it's just a form that has to be filed, and then your children can be immune from vaccination. But the mainstream media doesn't let you know about this. Many parents may not know, and many will reluctantly allow their children to be vaccinated against their better instincts, assuming that the school board and their medical advisors know better. The article makes some pretty intelligent comments about the current black and white pro versus anti-vaccine world that we live in. It says, one of the biggest myths being propagated in the compliant mainstream media today is that doctors are either pro-vaccine or anti-vaccine, and that anti-vaccine doctors are all quacks. However, nothing could be further from the truth. Doctors are not unified at all on their positions regarding, quote, the science of vaccines, nor are they unified in the position of removing informed consent to a medical procedure like vaccines. The two most extreme positions are obviously those who are 100% against vaccines and those who are 100% for vaccines and believe that all vaccines are safe and effective for all people, by force if necessary. But, the article continues, very few doctors fall into either of these two extremist positions, and yet it is the extreme pro-vaccine position that is being represented by the U.S. government, the Canadian government, and mainstream media as being the dominant position of the medical field. In between these two extreme views, however, is one where the vast majority of doctors practicing today would probably categorize their position. Many who consider themselves pro-vaccine, for example, do not believe that every single vaccine is appropriate for every single patient. Many doctors recommend a delayed vaccine schedule for some patients, and not always the recommended one-size-fits-all CDC childhood schedule or the similar schedules in other countries. Other doctors choose to recommend vaccines based on the actual science and merits, recommending some while determining that others are not worth the risk for the children, such as the seasonal flu shot. Turning from vaccines to medicines, there's a good article written by Kelly Crow, who, as far as I know, is no relative. She's writing for Canada's public broadcaster, CBC, and she has in the past written some articles in the mainstream media that go a little bit outside the normal bounds of criticism. She writes, there's a hidden power buried in the fine print of a federal Canadian law that could hold the key to accessing confidential information about the safety and efficacy of prescription drugs. But so far, only one person has used it, and the threat of a lawsuit still hangs over his head. Dr. Persaud, a family doctor in Toronto, asked and received thousands of pages of documents from Health Canada, and what he saw made him question the effectiveness of a popular morning sickness drug. And this is a sidebar by me. You might remember that thalidomide in the 1950s or 60s was a morning sickness drug and caused the most awful abnormalities in people. And recently, actually, Canada just finally provided a compensation package for some of these people who have gone through their lives with hands coming right out of their shoulders because they were born without arms and other significant malformations that caused them tremendous problems throughout their life. Anyway, back to Dr. Persaud. What about the thousands of pages of documents? What's in them? Well, he can't talk about it because Health Canada forced him to sign a confidentiality agreement and threatened him with legal action if he makes the data public. So a health law associate professor at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Matthew Herder, is calling on others, doctors, researchers, and journalists, to bombard Ottawa with their own demands for data using a legislative, what you might call, a loophole. This new law, which was called Vanessa's Law, Protecting Canadians from Unsafe Drugs Act, was passed, but it gives Health Canada the right to protect whatever data it deems to be confidential business information. But there was a loophole added that any person who carries out functions related to the protection or promotion of human health or the safety of the public can demand access to that confidential data. And that presumably covers doctors, researchers, and journalists if they're doing their job. And so Matthew Herder is trying to encourage a large number of these people to write to the government and try to loosen up some of this information on drugs, which once the government's archive of information that they've received from the pharmaceutical companies is revealed, it often shows that significant adverse effects were covered up by the pharmaceutical companies in cooperation with our government that's supposed to represent us. Hopefully this initiative will bear some fruit. I talked in a recent episode about the corrupt prescription of the antipsychotic Risperdal. The New York Times has followed up on that story. I believe it was in the Huffington Post that I first mentioned that. And they're talking about the prescribing of these drugs to children. In one case, for example, Andrew Rios started having seizures when he was only 5 months old. As they got progressively worse and the epilepsy medication resulted in violent behavior, he was prescribed the antipsychotic Risperdal. And this is a common practice amongst pharmaceutically oriented doctors, that if they give you a pill that causes a side effect, then instead of removing the pill, they give you another pill to try to mask the side effect. But eventually you get over-medicated and really bad things happen. The New York Times notes that there were 20,000 prescriptions for Risperdal and Seroquel and other antipsychotic medications written in 2014 for children 2 and younger, a 50% jump from 13,000 just 1 year before. Prescriptions for the antidepressant Prozac also rose 23% in 1 year for that age group to about 83,000. This is just really criminal malpractice. There seems to be a lot happening in Canada these days. Retraction Watch reports on a really old case, that of Memorial University former professor R.K. Chandra. This article says that finally Memorial University has released a 5-year-old report of an investigation confirming a former nutrition professor had conducted misconduct in a 2001 paper. So just as a reminder, it's now 2015. The misconduct occurred in 2001. How did it take so long? The paper was retracted in 2005. The report is dated 2009, but it took another 5 years for it to be revealed because the university was bogged down in litigation with Chandra, which was only over in July of 2015. And until the litigation was over, the university was intimidated and would not release the report. In some of this work of Chandra goes back way beyond 2001, a 2006 report by the Canadian Broadcasting Commission, Canada's public broadcaster, which I mentioned earlier, resulted in the retraction of a 1989 British Medical Journal study by Chandra. It said, the retraction note in the British Medical Journal said that this report was the product of a flawed investigation process and could not be relied upon. Now, it's interesting that Chandra is promoting nutritional medicine. I'm a big proponent of people eating better, and if supplements are necessary for various reasons, that's fine. But that doesn't mean that everybody who publishes anything on vitamins is honest and doing good research any more than we could say the same about people who study pharmaceuticals. It's just really important to clean up the mess made by the many, many corrupt scientists. I think it's worth, if you're interested in this, it's worth following Retraction Watch. Although it has a somewhat mainstream medicine bias, the sheer volume of retractions, many of which are due to outright fraud, is really quite shocking. So anybody who believes that science is self-correcting, I guess in one way you can say, well, Retraction Watch is showing that this is happening. But in many cases, the retractions are delayed. The scientists who have retractions go on to continue to research. Science just does not handle bad science any better than the police seem to handle bad cops within their midst. The institution protects itself, and it's important for the institution to protect the bad apples because they're scared of tarring the entire institution if they start going after the people who are doing corrupt research. But in the end, their reputation is even worse when it turns out that they were helping to defend. In this case, for almost 14 years, the process was not working properly. Chandra should have been published as a corrupt scientist back in 2001 or shortly after. It shouldn't have taken close to 15 years. In August of this year, Dr. Joseph Mercola on his website published some interesting research regarding saturated fats in diabetes. He says that researchers from the National Marine Mammal Foundation discovered that dolphins are able to switch in and out of a diabetes-like state, as well as develop metabolic syndrome, a cluster of symptoms that is often indicative of pre-diabetes in humans. To determine what might be driving metabolic syndrome in the dolphins, the researchers looked into their diet, which is primarily fish, and I presume these are captive dolphins not eating a natural diet. It turned out that the saturated fat heptadecanoic acid was most beneficial for metabolism, and dolphins with the highest levels in their blood had the lowest insulin and triglyceride levels. Several dolphins with low heptadecanoic acid levels were then fed fish high in this fat. Within 6 months, their markers of metabolic syndrome had improved. Also, the elevated levels of ferritin, a form of iron, which is a precursor to metabolic syndrome, were also lowered within 3 weeks of the high saturated fat diet. The authors of the science said, "We hypothesize that widespread movement away from the whole-fat dairy products in human populations may have created unanticipated heptadecanoic acid deficiencies, and in turn, this dietary deficiency may be playing a role in the global diabetes pandemic." Mercola goes on to say that while many people with diabetes think that they're following sound nutritional advice by shunning butter in favor of whole grain, the opposite is actually true. Butter, in fact, is a beneficial source of healthy saturated fats, especially when it's raw, organic, and grass-fed. In the dolphin study, butter was found to be particularly high in the beneficial heptadecanoic acid. So perhaps it's not surprising that past research has also linked it to a lower diabetes risk. Mercola quotes one study that included nearly 27,000 people middle-aged between the ages of 45 and 74 who were followed for 14 years. Those who ate 8 portions of full-fat dairy products a day cut their risk of diabetes by nearly 25% compared to those who ate fewer portions. According to the lead author, Dr. Ulrika Eriksson, our observations may contribute to clarifying previous findings regarding dietary facts and their food sources in relation to type 2 diabetes. The decreased risk at high intakes of high-fat dairy products, but not of low-fat dairy products, indicate that dairy fat, at least partly, explains observed protective associations between dairy intake and type 2 diabetes. And notice that I don't believe that it's absolutely necessary that these fats are obtained only from dairy products, but if you're going to, for example, eat a vegetarian or a vegan diet, you need to be very careful to make sure that you have adequate doses of these fats from plant-based sources. turning to an issue that is often treated as a medical issue, that is birth, which should not be treated as a medical issue. A group of researchers in Canada at the fairly prestigious McMaster University have looked at a provincial Ontario database of all midwifery booked pregnancies between 2006 and 2009 to compare women who had a planned home birth to a matched cohort of women with low-risk pregnancies who had a planned hospital birth attended by midwives. And what they found was they looked at 11,493 planned home births and the same number of planned hospital births, and they didn't find any difference between the two cases, except that interventions were higher amongst women who had a baby at the hospital. And what this is also saying is that many medical interventions in the birth process are unnecessary. But if you're in a hospital, you're much more likely to get one, whereas if you're having a birth at home, it's only likely that there'll be an intervention if the midwife detects some serious medical problem that's occurring during birth. The last medical item for this year, the LA Times is asking, how did an Ebola outbreak restart in Liberia? The West African country was twice declared free of the disease, and then recently a 15-year-old boy contracted the virus, or at least that's what they believe. His father and brother also tested positive, although it doesn't say anything about them actually having any health impacts. How the latest Ebola case was transmitted to Nathan Groot, a 15-year-old from Monrovia, remains a mystery. But nobody ever thinks, how accurate are these Ebola tests? If an Ebola test is say, 99% accurate, and I reported earlier that in some cases the risk of false positives with an Ebola test was as high as 20%, so it's nowhere near 99% accurate. If you test thousands or millions of people with a test that's 99% accurate, you will get hundreds or thousands of false positive results. And if you restrict it by just saying, well, somebody has to have a fever and a cough or some other symptoms, then you're still going to have many, many of these cases. And so the criticisms of the World Health Organization that they didn't do enough testing, that they didn't report early enough, and therefore they didn't detect these small outbreaks, as Peter Piot, one of the people who claimed to have discovered the Ebola virus back in 1977 in one of the most shoddy scientific papers I've ever read in my life. Peter Piot said there was a need to improve the capacity of countries to detect small outbreaks early to prevent them turning into major emergencies. But if they run around Africa with an Ebola test kit, everybody who has, say, a fever, and ignoring what they used to do, which was only people who'd been in contact with another Ebola case would be tested. They're going to find thousands, possibly millions, of cases of Ebola, and they can keep the money machine going forever. It will result in the generation of a very profitable vaccine, new drugs, and will improve the health of Africans, not a single iota. Let's talk about environmental issues. In a sense, these are medical issues because it is from our environment that we receive most of the toxins that make us sick. It's from the environment that we receive the food and water that can make us healthy if it's clean and uncontaminated. The Detroit Free Press has been following the scandal of the Flint water system. In order to save money, the managers of the bankrupt city of Flint decided to start pumping water out of the highly polluted Flint River instead of connecting to the Detroit water system as they had in the past. The Nancy Kerfer and the Detroit Free Press writes, "When did the state of Michigan first learn that kids in Flint had been poisoned by lead in the city's drinking water? This is one of the most critical questions to answer in the aftermath of a public health crisis that's still unfolding in one of the state's largest cities. And it shouldn't be a hard question to answer. But when the reporter asked Governor Rick Snyder this week, which was the week of December 17th, he said he couldn't recall. Officials at the State Department of Health said they didn't know what was happening until a Flint pediatrician released her own analysis in September Even though data previously collected by the state showed the same trend, a reversal in a decades-long decline in the percentage of kids with lead in their blood. For months, state officials denied that the water in Flint had problems. In July, a spokesman told Michigan Radio that folks in Flint could, quote, relax. In an internal email, the spokesman Werfel wrote, the community groups were keeping people in Flint hopped up. Excited, I guess that's what he means. When Mona Hanna Atisha, the Flint pediatrician, released her analysis of Flint kids' blood lead levels, the state's immediate response across multiple departments was to attempt to discredit her work. Snyder's spokesman said that the data used by the pediatrician, who has degrees in medicine and public health, was, quote, spliced and diced. While much of the world was focused on CO2 at the Paris Climate Conference, which I think was the 20th or so conference, how many times do people who are opposed to fossil fuels have to get on airplanes and fly around to nice locations like Bali and Paris in order to talk about agreements that are not worth the paper that they're published on because nothing will actually happen, and ignore the real environmental problems in the world? In Beijing, one of those is particulate-based smog. China has issued two, quote, red alerts in Beijing because of the bad air quality. And I have actually personally been in Beijing when the air quality was really bad. When I was driving back to the airport, I could barely see the car in front of my taxi. The air quality was that bad. Now, interestingly enough, I was born near London. My parents lived in London in the 1950s before the British Clean Air Act was brought in. And they had several famous fogs back then, which the British government at first tried to blame on a flu epidemic, to blame the associated deaths on a flu epidemic. But it was pretty obvious to anybody that this was due to burning a large amount of coal. And the same thing is believed to be happening in China. Now, it's true that people who are opposed to global warming want to burn less coal, but that won't necessarily improve the environmental problems. And if it results in, for example, China moving to nuclear power plants or burning coal and burying the CO2 underground, it won't necessarily improve the air quality. I guess the good news is that when England got serious about improving the air quality in London, England, they did it with only a few years. Both the air quality and the water quality in the River Thames, the fish came back to the Thames. Buildings in London that when I was a child in the 1950s were all black are now beautiful white stone again. So improvement is possible if people take it seriously. Also, another quite different environmental catastrophe occurred in Shenzhen, which is a city near Hong Kong where a huge amount of manufacturing occurs. A large pile of dirt and construction debris collapsed and engulfed dozens of buildings, and many people disappeared. The wave of earth buried or toppled 33 buildings, including apartments, worker dormitories, and factories. As of December 21st, 2015, 81 people were still missing. And who knows what toxins may be in this pile of mud. It should be pretty obvious that if you pile up mud and you get enough rain, that it will all collapse. But if you're a corrupt government official or a corrupt construction business owner, you might try to pretend that that's not the issue. And these are just two of the major environmental catastrophes that China has fallen prey to over the past years since the economic development. Again, if there was a true democracy, things would get better. And I think in the 1960s and 70s, things did get better in North America. When governments started to react to some of the horrible environmental catastrophes that had occurred in the Americas since then. But we're getting very sloppy, and we're backsliding, as the article on Flint, Michigan's water system states. It's also important to know that the pollution that was generated in North America and Europe in the 1800s and 1900s is still with us in many cases and may come back to haunt us. They might be buried for now, but a big flood or something else could release huge quantities of toxins into a river system. So this keeps, we require eternal vigilance. And also, we need to keep thinking smarter about development so that we can think about these problems, not allow them to happen, and pay attention to these issues with our governments and not get diverted by issues like ISIS, which by comparison is a pretty small problem. But terrorism is important. It's important both for the rights it affects from the actions of the terrorists, but probably more importantly for the rights it affects from those who claim to be protecting us against terrorists. Every time there's a terrorist attack, there are law enforcement and intelligence officials who claim that encryption is the problem. And it's true that that terrorists are instructed to use applications like Apple's iMessage that are encrypted. There are other even more secure applications. But companies like Apple are staying firm, and Tim Cook recently said, if the government lays a proper warrant on us today, then we will give the specific information that is requested because we have to by law. But in the case of encrypted information, we don't have it to give. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, there should be some kind of a backdoor or anything. Encryption is something I know enough about to be dangerous, and it's very clear to everybody who has any knowledge in this area that backdoor destroys encryption. If there is a backdoor for, say, the FBI or the NSA, it will not remain secret for two reasons. First of all, somebody in the NSA or FBI may leak it. They may not leak it, say, directly to ISIS, but they may leak it to the Drug Enforcement Agency, and thus it might end up in the hands of Mexican drug cartels, and then somebody may decide this is information that's saleable and sell it to ISIS. So this information will get out. Secondly, if there is a backdoor, other people who are smart mathematicians will discover the backdoor independently, and you will never know whether the communications that you have are secure. And why are some of the reasons we need secure encrypted information? Well, let's say that you're working on a human rights issue. Let's say you're working with people who are fighting for democracy in Saudi Arabia. What happens if the NSA can interpret those communications and then decides to turn them over to the Saudi government? Well, somebody gets their head chopped off by the Saudi government. Even if you think you're an ordinary person of no interest and you're not doing anything wrong, you may discuss your health problems in your messages, your love life, ideas that are hard formed, and in 10 years from now may come back to haunt you. You were hypothesizing something that you regret you ever said, and if it's encrypted, well, you know, that's between you and whoever you said it to. But if not, when you decide to run for office, you could find that all of a sudden this stuff is dredged up and destroys your reputation at the worst possible time. Well, the best possible time for the people who want to stop you from running. If you are, for example, a person who is criticizing the government of Michigan for the water in Flint, or you're criticizing the Chinese government's environmental record, or you're criticizing some of the dictators in the Middle East, you're very vulnerable if your communications become uncovered. Russia Today on the 27th of December reported a perfect example of why encryption is not going to help when we actually have the information in front of us and we ignore it. The director of a Belgian school where the youngest perpetrator of the terrorist attack in Paris studied warned his superior of the young man's radicalization. The warning was not passed on, and the director was subsequently sacked. That's the person who reported it, who got sacked, not the person who didn't report it. Bilal Hadfi was a French national living in Brussels before going to Syria earlier this year to join the Islamic State. On November 13th, he blew himself up outside the national soccer stadium, part of the terrorist strikes that claimed 130 lives in Paris. His radicalization was reported by his Belgian school director, Chris Fitchpin, in late April, but the warning never made it past his superior, Charles Huguenin, the newspaper De Morgen reported on Saturday. For example, before disappearing, Hadfi cheered the killing of editors of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo and posed with a jihadist flag in photos published on his Facebook account. Now, just stop for a minute. These were not encrypted activities. These were activities that were publicly known to a number of people, and the director of the school did the right thing and reported it to his superior. His superior, Huguenin, told the newspaper that he didn't alert police about Hadfi's radicalization because by that time it was, quote, already too late. I guess he'd left the country, so what harm could he do? I guess the superior wasn't smart enough to think that he might come back and do something awful as he did. And it would have been much more awful if he'd managed to get inside the soccer stadium when he blew himself up outside. The damage was minimized. It would have been a lot more than 130 people killed if he had achieved what he wanted. So here's an example where there is information in the zeal for intelligence agencies to get every phone call we make, every text message, to have no encryption at all. They're not putting the resources into following up on leads of radicalization, whether it's jihadist or right-wing radicalization or some other kind of radicalization. There are often signs, statements that are made publicly, and if the authorities don't follow up on these, they can miss stopping some really terrible events. Now for a little bit of humor. In December, the same month we're recording this, a survey of Republican voters by public policy polling discovered that 13% of Republicans did not want to bomb Agrabah. And that means, if I do the math right, that 87% of Republicans do want to bomb Agrabah. The problem, of course, is that Agrabah is a mythical country in a Disney movie and not a real country, which I guess shows the level of education and intelligence that goes into international policy decisions. It's a little bit unfair that they just polled Republican voters, because my suspicion is if they'd polled Democratic voters, they would have had maybe not quite the same percentage, but significant, especially amongst the supporters of the warmonger Hillary Clinton. And just so that people know, I'm not a big fan of either of the American parties. And also, in full disclosure, I'm also not an American, so I don't really get to choose. But the enthusiasm for war of all of the Republican candidates, as well as Hillary Clinton, is a little bit disconcerting, especially considering how ineffective the wars are, except at generating massive profits for the military-industrial complex. I have said many times that many people criticize American foreign policy, and of course Canadians and Europeans generally tag along with whatever the Americans want to do with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Many people have criticized American foreign policy as highly ineffective. The wars go on forever, they're never really won, they're never really lost. I actually think American foreign policy is incredibly effective because the purpose is to enrich the inside the beltway military contractors. Finally, a tweet from Ayan Hirsi Ali, who is the former Muslim who was the favorite of people who hate Muslims. She just wrote, "The truth about the hijab is anything but modest. All it does is reduce a woman to her genitalia." This was a tweet, which is perhaps why it was so short. So I responded back to this. I'm not a Twitter friend of Ayan Hirsi Ali, but I wrote, "A hijab is just a frickin' scarf like Catholic women wore before the 1960s change in Christian dogma." I think most people don't understand that the hijab is, if you look it up in the dictionary, it just covers the head and the neck. It leaves the face uncovered, and it doesn't cover the rest of the body. Now, it may be true that there are apparently a couple of countries in the world where women have to wear this, but the question, that's not really the general question. The question is, if a woman in America or Canada or Europe chooses to wear the hijab, is there a problem with this? And how does it reduce a woman to her genitalia? I mean, even Western women are forced, like Western men, to cover their genitalia at pretty much all times when they're in public. Breasts, for people who know anything about anatomy, are not actually genitalia. And the hijab doesn't cover a woman's breasts anyway, and most Western women cover most of their breasts most of the time, so I just don't get this at all. But somehow the fact that Muslim women wear a scarf on their head to appear modest is sinful, and yet when Christian women want to be modest, that is lauded. To me, if a woman wants to show her sexuality by wearing tight dresses and tight shirts, that's her choice, and everybody should respect that. Obviously, there are places where it's not appropriate, and some people may make others uncomfortable by doing this. The same thing if a woman wants to show herself as modest by wearing some kind of traditional garb, I don't really see what harm that does. In the 1960s, when I was a child, there were all kinds of rules about when you could wear hats. Women had to wear a hat inside church. Men couldn't wear a hat inside. Sikhs wear a turban at all times, which has sometimes been controversial. Observant Jewish men wear a minimalistic hat on their head. I mean, these things are deeply embedded in society, and people within those societies feel it is very important. There's not too many people other than Jews who can understand the reason to wear a skull cap, and yet it's very important to their feeling of being observant and religious, and more power to them. If it makes them feel that way, that's great. Ayaan Hirsi Ali also said, "The hijab as a symbol justifies the rape of women who refuse to wear it. It's time to discard it like the chastity belt." Well, if there are countries where if a woman doesn't dress right, there's open season, and it's okay for men to rape her, then that country has a huge problem. But again, it has nothing to do with women who choose voluntarily to wear the hijab or other forms of traditional Muslim wear like the niqab. It has nothing to do with this as a choice. If we're going to give people a choice, they should have the choice to wear the hijab or the choice not to wear it. Now the subject of justice. I reported earlier about a judge who threatened to jail children who refused to eat lunch with their father. And there has been a complaint against this judge filed by the Michigan Judicial Tenure Commission. The judge, Lisa Gorsica, appears to have committed a long list of infractions, and a process has begun that may result in her removal from office. Gorsica, re-elected to a six-year term last year, ordered three children, 13, 10, and 9 years old at the time, detained on June 24th after they refused to eat with their father, who had moved to Israel and remarried after a bitter divorce from his former wife. At the June hearing, the eldest child said he had witnessed his father hit his mother, something that the father has denied doing. Gorsica declared the father a great man and likened the boy to a member of Charles Manson's cult, telling him, quote, "You have no manners," saying that she doubted he had a high IQ, and ordering him to spend the summer in a detention facility where she said he would be, quote, "going to the bathroom in public, and he might stay there until," quote, "he graduates from high school." The judge made similar threats to the younger children, asking Natalie, "You want to have your birthdays in Children's Village? Do you like going to the bathroom in front of people?" The girl who cried during the hearing, I can't understand why, ultimately chose not to eat with her father either. Eventually, the judge reversed course and allowed the children to attend summer camp after more than 2 weeks, when her decision and the verbal barbs at the children ignited a national media firestorm. It would be nice to think that there was some comeback when children in a bitter custody dispute are not being listened to and respected. And I understand, and I want to repeat this, that it's not every father who is the bad guy. There are mothers who are attempting to demonize the fathers. And the mother may be the bad person will be the bad person in some relationships, but in this case, just listening to what the judge said to the children, attempting to coerce them into agreeing to have a relationship with their father that they didn't want. And I think that 13, 10, and 9-year-olds are perfectly capable of deciding that they don't want to have a relationship with one parent. I think the courts could make it clear that if they ever change their minds, that could be accepted, because it could be that after some time they rethink and decide that they want to attempt to have a relationship. That's fine. But what the judge said was really unconscionable. And in that great friend of the West, Saudi Arabia, the distraught parents of a teenager believed to be on the brink of being beheaded by Saudi authorities have launched a last-ditch appeal to the world for help. Abdullah al-Zahar was arrested after taking part in a protest in the country's restive Shia eastern province with other young Saudis in March 2012 when he was just 15. Campaign group Reprieve says his signed confession that led to his death sentence in October 2014 came only after the boy was tortured. Saudi security officials were alleged to have beaten him with wire iron rods and denied him access to his family or a lawyer. Reprieve, which campaigns against the death penalty, told IB Times UK, which reported this story, that the now 19-year-old is at imminent risk of being executed after recently being moved to solitary confinement. It's sad that when ISIS does something barbaric, like chop people's heads off or burn them to death, the world is rightly outraged. But when a powerful oil-producing country like Saudi Arabia does things that are just as barbaric, the world turns a blind eye, even though Saudi Arabia is probably killing more people in as barbaric ways as ISIS is. And the West cannot be too complacent. There is an article by Will Potter on TED.com regarding the United States secret prisons over the years. And by secret, he doesn't mean that people didn't know that the prisons existed, but what went on them was secret and was not known. He starts with the Japanese internment camps, where 120,000 Japanese Americans were interned during World War II. It's interesting that in the recent survey I mentioned about Republicans, the majority of Republicans felt that this was a mistake. That's nice to hear. Alcatraz was in many ways a secret prison. What went on there stayed there. It was brutal and vicious. And after Alcatraz, in 1963, a prison at Marion was created, which had units called CARE, Control and Rehabilitation Effort, which was basically solitary confinement and what were described as psychological attack sessions. The control unit kept prisoners in solitary confinement for 22 hours at a time. There were reports of widespread brutality. A former warden of the Marion prison told Mother Jones magazine in 1990, "The purpose of the Marion control unit is to control revolutionary attitudes in the prison system and the society at large." After a prison-wide strike and then the murder of two guards at Marion in the early 1980s, the entire prison effectively became a control unit. Later, government officials called for an even more extreme facility, and the Supermax Florence prison in Colorado was built. Will Potter also mentions a prison I did not know about, the Lexington HSU, High Security Unit, which is a women's prison in Lexington, Kentucky, created to house political prisoners belonging to any organization that, according to the Bureau of Prisons, quote, attempts to disrupt or overthrow the government of the U.S., which is pretty easy to define. You could throw a lot of people in there. The Lexington HSU existed below ground in total isolation from the outside world and with radically restricted prisoner communication and visitations. The women were subject to constant fluorescent lighting, almost daily strip searches, and sensory deprivation. The purpose, according to a report by Dr. Richard Korn for the ACLU, was to reduce prisoners to a state of submission essential for ideological conversion. The Lexington HSU was closed in 1988 after protests by various rights groups. Now we have what are called communication management units, which similarly take people considered to be terrorists and limit them to one 15-minute telephone call per month, one 6-page letter per week, and one 1-hour visit per month. Will Potter reports that there were protests about this, but then the Justice Department quietly opened the first communications management unit in Terre Haute in Indiana, and then later another one in Marion, Illinois, which is, I guess, different than the original Marion prison. Recently, it was discovered it wasn't just the federal government, but the Chicago Police Department had an operation in Holman Square where people could disappear for some period of time. They would be questioned without a lawyer. There were no records kept. It was, again, a secret prison in that the judicial processes did not operate at Holman Square. The moral of this story is that we cannot close our eyes to abuses of the judicial system, because people in power will use the judicial system against marginalized groups, especially groups that are perhaps careless in their rhetoric, perhaps groups that contain some people who are a little bit or a lot dangerous, but then entire groups of people who may have completely nonviolent methods of operation may be swept together. At first, it might be Muslims who are true terrorists, but then we might sweep up anybody who complains about American wars in Muslim countries. It might be that there are a handful of environmentalists who want to burn things down. They generally don't want to kill people or kill animals, but they might burn a few buildings down. But then it could be that anybody who opposes a major pipeline development or some other industrial development could be imprisoned. When it happens in a country like Saudi Arabia or China or Russia, we turn up our noses and say how uncivilized. But when it happens in our own country, we tend to turn a blind eye. But as that famous German philosopher said, first they came for the others, and when they come for you, there will be nobody left to help you. Badly paraphrased, I know. I hope I haven't depressed you too much. Thank you for listening to How Positive Are You? Don't forget to send me a message if you have feedback on the show, if you have any suggestions for future guests. And until then, thank you for listening, and I'll talk to you again next week. Goodbye.